Our loving God, we thank you that you spoke so clearly to your people back in those early days, that you gave them clear instructions and commands. And so as we come today to reflect on those same words, give us insight, give us wisdom, give us a willingness to understand and to believe what it is you say to us through these words. These things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. In change management, this graph is often used. It's called the Rogers diffusion of innovation, and it was developed by someone called Evert Rogers. He identified that when any change takes place, on the left-hand side, you have the innovators and the early adopters. These are the people that often either bring about a change or suggest a change, and then those who very quickly and very easily understand why a change is being made and will support that change. The next section is by far the largest, the early majority and the late majority. These are people who will eventually accept change, and because they are the largest group, it is often the reason that change happens slowly. Because if you're trying to institute a change, whether it be in an organization or, in fact, in any sphere of life, changes are more likely to stick if you can take the majority of people with you. And those in the early and late majority often require a bit more convincing than the innovators and the early adopters. For example, this was why from the moment of first suggesting it through to when we actually did adopt the Unitary Constitution as the way that we govern this congregation, it took us 8 months. 8 months. Because there needed to be time to talk things through, to reflect and to ensure that the majority, both early and late, were on board so that the change would be made successfully. And then at the very end, bringing up the coo's tail of this graph are the group called the laggards. Those at the very end of the change. At best, Rogers suggests that these are the people who will accept change, but they will be the last to do so. They will take a lot of more convincing. They will likely not be particularly happy, but they will eventually accept a change. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, he deems, is that these are the folk that remain completely and utterly resistant to any kind of change. Often, he notes, in spite of evidence that supports that the change has actually been for the better. I share that with you because I wonder, having heard the story of the people of God reaching this point in their history, having reflected last Sunday on the centuries of history that led them to the point of being on the edge of the Promised Land, and then having reflected on the failure to enter into the Promised Land, which necessitated a further 40 years of wandering, I wonder where on this graph the people of God would have found themselves. Would there have been that same kind of attention that we know today, where you've got a smaller group of people at one end who are champing at the bit saying, we're here again, let's just go straight in. And at the other end, you've got the group that are still clinging on to this idea that somehow they're better off either in the desert or, God forbid, back in Egypt. Are they experiencing that tension? I suspect that they probably were. And it takes a wise leader to navigate people through this kind of change, to navigate people through the tensions that exist between those that seek to press on and those that would rather stay where they are. Now, Joshua is a wise leader. And undoubtedly, there were people who were ready and willing and able to get straight into the promised land and get on with the task that God had given them. And it must have been frustrating for them, those innovators and early adopters, to hear him say, "No, not yet. Now is not quite the time for us to go in. We need to do something else first. We need to do something to make sure that it's not just those at the forefront of change that are going to be leading us into the promised land, but we are taking the majority of the people with us. We need to make sure that everybody, as far as possible, with the exception perhaps of the laggards, is on board with what we are about to do." So what does he do? What does Joshua do to ensure that the majority of people are on board with this plan? Well, he consults with God. He meets with God. He spends time listening to the instruction of the Lord to ensure that the people are clear about what it is that God intends for them to do and how it is God is going to help them to do it. He checks in with God, knowing that only God is going to make a success of this. We begin in the first five verses of hearing a reiteration of the promises that God has made. He reminds the people that he has given them this land and that it is theirs to settle. He gives landmarks to delineate exactly where within this space of land the people are going to settle. And he reiterates that promise, "As it was with Moses, so shall I be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you." We read that in verse 5. Now, God has made all of these promises before. Nothing in the first five verses should come as a surprise to Joshua, because these are things that have been repeated throughout the Israelites' time in the wilderness. So why does God restate these promises here? Well, I think that there are two reasons. The first reason is that people are slow to trust and quick to forget. Slow to trust and quick to forget. That was the story of the first attempt into the promised land. God has said to his people, "I've given you this land, it is yours to settle. Yes, there are challenges along the way. Yes, there will be difficulties, but I am with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you." And the people, rather than trusting in that promise, instead trusted in the report of the 10 other spies who said, "This is madness. There's no way that we can successfully make it into the promised land." And so it is that God is reiterating this to remind the people of what is true. He wants the people to trust his judgment and his promises over the observations of people. And in all honesty, this is an act of pure grace that God gives such reassurance. It is an act of pure grace because we are not deserving of God's comfort. We are not deserving of his desire to do what is best for us. So it is an act of pure grace that he reminds the people. God would have been well within his rights to say, "I've told you once, I don't need to tell you again." How many of you, as parents or as guardians, have been caring for children and have said, "If I've told you once, it should be enough. Just do as you're told"? God is not like that. He could choose to be, but he's not. Instead, he graciously reminds us, he says, "I've said it before, but I'll say it again. I will never leave you, nor will I forsake you." He demonstrates a patience with us that we so often struggle to demonstrate with one another. The second reason that he reiterates these promises is because they ground what comes next. God is reminding them of these promises because he's about to go on to issue instructions and commands. He's about to tell them the things that they will need to do in order to make a success of this entering into the promised land. Now again, God could simply have said, "Here's what you have to do, just do it, okay? But he doesn't. He explains, he gives the reasoning behind obedience to his commands. He says, I've made these promises to you that you will have all of this, and now, in order to get that, here's what you need to do. So he is giving us a foundation for the instructions that are about to be issued. These promises ground what comes next. And what does come next are the key verses in this chapter, verses 6 to 9. Now, our verse of the year, this year, is verse 9, which if you have the congregational newsletter for January, you will have. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Don't be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. That is the verse for us. But you will have noticed as this passage was read to us by Janice that there is a great deal of repetition in these verses, verses 6 to 9. So rather than going through them systematically instead, let's look at the themes. Let's look at the repeated words and phrases that come up again and again in these verses. First of all, we have the do's, the things that God says, do this. Firstly, be strong and courageous. Do be strong. Do be courageous. In fact, at one point he says, be strong and very courageous. Now, when God tells us to be strong, I don't think he means go to the gym and start doing weights. I don't think he means build up an arsenal for yourself that will allow you to steamroll over your enemies. I think what he means is don't be strong in human terms, but rely upon my strength, the strength of God. Time and again in the Bible, through the stories that we read and the unfolding of human history, we see that more often than not, the strength of God is displayed not in power, but in weakness. Think of the story of Gideon, the judge who was called to save Israel from the Philistines, and he built himself up a strong army, 30,000 fighting men. And God says, that's too many. And eventually he whittles the number down to 300 men. Which on human terms you think, well, this is suicide. The Greeks in the fable of Leonidas, they had 300 Spartans, the best soldiers of their day. And even they knew that their attempt to stop the Persian army was suicide. And yet in the story of Gideon, God gives victory to 300 men. Further on in the history of Israel, you have the story of David. His brothers are fighting with King Saul, and the armies are positioned as such that essentially they're at a stalemate. If one attacks, then it's going to mean mutual destruction. So they're kind of standing off against one another, and the Philistines decide, let's send out our strongest warrior to taunt them. And Goliath, the giant, comes out, and he goads Israel. And he says, is there no one among you who's going to come and fight me? And the army of Israel says, no, there's not. We're not coming out to face you. And it was a shepherd boy, David, who heard the call of the giant and said, I'll sort this out. I'll deal with this. And everyone thought he was mad. His brothers and the king all said, don't do it, David. You'll be slaughtered. And yet with the wisdom and strength of God and a sling with a stone, the giant was felled. And God gave victory in weakness. The greatest victory of all came in Jesus Christ. Even to his closest friends, as Jesus hung upon the cross of Calvary, as his spirit left his body, as he uttered the words, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, and then it is finished, and as he bowed his head and he died, All of his friends, all of his followers looked at the crucified Christ and said, "We have lost. We have been beaten. This great movement that Jesus was starting up has just finished because our leader is dead. The Romans have won. They've beaten us once again." What they did not understand at the time is that the victory that Christ won in that moment was not one of earthly victory. It was not a conquering of the Roman Empire. It was not an overturning of those worldly powers, but rather it was a defeat of sin. It was the defeat of death itself. Jesus in that moment had taken upon himself the sin of the world and said, "I will bear it. And I will bear the punishment of God's wrath." And when he said, "It is finished," he was declaring the greatest victory that's ever been won. For through his death, we can come back to God, set free from all our sin, for he has paid the price. In weakness, God brought victory. But of course, we know that's not the end of Jesus' story, because there needed to be some way of communicating that and saying to his followers, "Do you realize we've won?" And so we have the resurrection of Jesus 3 days later, returning to his friends and saying, "Look what God has done. Look at the victory that God brought about in weakness." And so that is the kind of strength I think God calls us to have, not power in a worldly sense, but rather to rely upon the strength of God and to know that even in the most dire of circumstances, God is able to bring about great victories beyond our knowledge and our understanding. And that's where courage comes from. Courage not in our own ability, but in the faithfulness of God. Because there will be times when it appears as though we are going to be defeated. There will be times when it will feel as though God has abandoned us and left us to our fate. There will be times when we, as earthly people, are looking at a situation and saying, "This is impossible. Nothing can be done about this. Evil has triumphed." God says, "Don't think like that. Be courageous. Trust in my strength. Believe that I can deliver you from this. Know that I am with you even when it feels like I'm not. Because my strength is made most powerful in weakness, and I can bring victory where defeat seems certain." Be strong and courageous. The other do, which we pick up in verses 7 and 8, is obedience and obey the law that God has given. Now, there's been a lot of talk in the news recently about quid pro quos. I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That is not what God is saying here when he says obey the law. It sounds it because he does say that be careful to do everything that is written in the law, then you will be prosperous and successful. It sounds like he's basically saying, if you obey my law, then I will make sure that you have success. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. How can we be sure that that's not what God means? Well, again, we think about the wider story of the Bible. Because if the way God worked was, obey my commands and you'll get X, Y, and Z, then none of us would have anything. Because no one can obey the laws of God to the standard that he calls us to. No one can perfectly live in accordance with the law of God. In fact, that's the point of the law. The point of the law is to show us that nobody's perfect. Even the best among us has fallen in some way. So if God was really saying, keep my law and you'll have success, then the Israelites are doomed to failure because they can't keep the law. They don't keep the law. Instead, I think when God says, following my law will bring you prosperity and success, what he is saying is that following my law is the best thing that you can do for yourself. Because in spite of what you may think, my law is there for your benefit. My law is there so that you can live the best life that you can. Following my way, yes, will restrict you in some senses, but it will free you in others. And you will be able to enjoy your life. You'll be able to have as full an experience of life as you can in this sinful world. That is why I think he asks and instructs his people to obey the law so that they will live their best life and so that others will see how the Israelites are living and will see what it means to live following God's ways and think, do you know, I'd like a bit of that too. I want what they've got. And people are then attracted and brought into God's kingdom. That's the way that it worked in the time of Israel. Israel was supposed to be attractional and draw people in, whereas in the church today, we are sent out. So that's why obeying the law was so important. It brought people in. It attracted them. Those were the do's. Now we have the don'ts. Firstly, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Fear is the great enemy of faith. Fear implies that God is not enough. If we are afraid, if we live in fear, then we don't really believe that God can deliver us. We don't really believe that God is enough for us. That is something that we as Christians can receive when we come to know God. We can live without fear. For we trust and believe that no matter what happens to us in this life, God's got us. And even if this life is terrible from start to finish, well, there's the next life, which is better, far better. It's why so many earthly powers are antagonistic toward the Christian faith. It's why persecution of Christians is so frequent in our world. Because dictators and those with power and authority hear the Christian message and they think, my goodness, if that's true, I've got something to lose. If that's true, then my control over the people is gone. Because they won't fear me anymore. Jesus himself said, don't be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. In other words, if you believe in God, if you believe in the resurrection to eternal life, if you believe that he has saved you through Christ, then the worst that anybody can do to you in this world is kill you. But even then, well, fine, do it. All you're doing is sending me to God sooner than I would have expected. And without that fear, suddenly people become much harder to control. There's this conspiracy theory that institutional religion has been used throughout the centuries to control and manipulate the masses. I think it was Karl Marx that said religion is the opiate of the masses. In other words, religion is used to keep people under control. Now, I'm not saying that that hasn't happened and that institutionalized religion hasn't been used to oppress, because it undoubtedly has. But true Christianity cannot oppress. True Christianity cannot control people, because the message of Christianity is you've been set free. No earthly power can control you anymore. No earthly authority can do anything to you anymore. Only God can. You've been set free. So don't live in fear. Don't be afraid. The spirit that God has given us, this is from 2 Timothy, the spirit God has given us is not one of timidity or fear, but one of power, love, and self-discipline. So don't be afraid. And also don't be discouraged. Now, I will confess that of all the things, all the do's and don'ts, this is the one where I thought, yeah, I struggle with that. I don't live in fear, but discouragement can come very easily, and often in the form of questions. God, where are you, and why aren't you working as I'd expect? God, why are we in your church so focused on the wrong things and not the things of your kingdom? God, why is it so hard to reach the people of our parish? God, why is it so challenging when we are doing our best to be faithful to you? Why is it so challenging to bring people in to this community of faith? Those are the questions that often will leave me feeling discouraged and down and disappointed and wondering as to what God is up to. The solution to that feeling of discouragement, indeed the solution to being afraid, comes at the end of verse 9. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. A reminder, again, of the promises God has made. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you wherever you go. When fear comes, when discouragement comes, we do well to ground ourselves and remind ourselves of the truths and the promises of God, and to remember that God never breaks a promise. He always keeps his word. And I know that I need to do that more when I feel discouraged. Come back to the promises that God has made. In response to these words of God, the people prepare and they obey. Joshua sends the officers out to the people and says, "Get ready. We've heard from the Lord. He's issued his instructions. Now it's time to get ready to go. Now there's a time of action." The passage doesn't really convey this, but I couldn't help but read verses 10 and 11 and get a sense of the sudden buzz and the excitement and the action of people saying, "Oh, right, now it's time to go." The whole camp of God's people packing their stuff up and getting ready to depart into the promised land. Everybody's getting ready. They're all obeying the command to go. But nowhere is this preparation and obedience seen more clearly than with the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. These three groups had already found their home. The passage tells us that they had settled already on the east side of the Jordan River. They'd found home. And now they were being asked, in fact, they were reminded of a promise that they'd made. God said to them, "Okay, you want this side of the Jordan River? Grand, I'll give that to you. But when it comes the time for the rest of your people to cross the river, your fighting men have to go and help them. Because you've basically got your bit of the promised land early. And that's great for you, but the rest are going to need your help." So having settled, having come from slavery in Egypt, through the wilderness, and 40 years of wandering, those three tribes, 2.5 tribes, have settled. They've found home, and now this guy Joshua is coming to them and saying, "Your fighting men are coming with us to help us as we settle the rest of Israel." And I dare say that it was not an easy thing for them to hear, but the response that we get is astonishing, because there's no resentment. There's no trying to weasel out of it. There's no bargaining. They simply say, "Whatever you command us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go." What a great example of obedience that is to the will of God. Even although they'd found their home, without question, they were ready. They took up arms and they said, "Okay, Wherever you send us, we will go, and whatever you command us to do, we will do. It's an astonishing obedience. And it required personal sacrifice, because some of those men didn't know if they were coming back. They had families, they had wives and children. They would not have known if they were going to return to them, and yet, without question, they went. And it leaves me with a question, which is, to what extent are we ready or willing to make such personal sacrifices if it means obeying God? I know we often ask these questions in the abstract, don't we? And we kind of ruminate and think, oh, you know, if God came and said I had to give up my house, of course I would do it. And if I had to give up this, I would do it, and that, and so on. And we all sound very pious and very godly. But seriously, if God comes and says, I need you to give this up, I need you to make a sacrifice for me, and in doing so, you're obeying me, would you actually do it? Because let's be honest, when we are asked to give up even the smallest things, it's hard and a struggle, and it's begrudging. My goodness, I can think in my own life when Ruth comes and says, can I have one of your chocolate biscuits, or can I have one of your things? Very rare. Of course, darling, take as much as you want. No, it's usually, oh, but you've got your own stuff. Stop coming for my stuff. And that's over something small. There is such an example that we can look to here. Seriously, when it comes to making sacrifices for God, when it comes to saying those little things that God is asking me to do or to give up so that I could obey him, look to the Gadites, the Reubenites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Look at how they were willing to leave home and family and without question go and help their fellow Israelites settle the land. And then think in your own life, could I do that? And if the answer is no, and let's be honest, for most of us the answer would be we wouldn't be able to, and if we did, it would be begrudging. Then we need to get on our knees and pray to God and say, help me. Help me to be better at sacrificing my own things for the sake of your things. Because God's things are far more important than ours. And you can see how much these people are in tune with God, because they finish the chapter. And incidentally, this is why this is one of the few times in this series we'll read the whole of a chapter. But they finish with the words that God himself had used, only be strong and courageous. It's the fourth time that phrase appears in the chapter, three times it's uttered by God, the final time it's said by this tribe. That is how in tune they were with the will of God, that they were using his own words to say, we're ready to go. Be strong and courageous. So there's a great example to be found in this tribe. Before embarking on the resettling of the land promised to them by God, the Israelites checked in with him, and he gave them these great encouraging words. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. As we prepare to embark on what I believe will be a significant year for us, one of arriving at a God-given destination, the same command is given to encourage us. We are to be strong and courageous. We are not to have a spirit of fear. We are not to be discouraged. We are to obey God and focus on his things, not worldly things. There will be challenges, but the destination is worth it. And we are to remember that no matter what happens, he is with us wherever we go. Only be strong and courageous. Amen, and thanks be to God for his word to us today.